Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined on this live edition of the Daily Friend Show. Well, live if you're watching at 1:30 on Friday on YouTube. Not live if you're listening on audio only, but anyway, I'm joined today by Anlu Kiewa. Anlu, how are you doing?
Hello, Nicholas. I am doing very well, thank you. My first time that I'm on in spring season, so very happy.
Indeed, spring is in the air, and South Africa continues to be a place that intrigues and gives us many things to talk about, which we shall get into today on this lovely Friday. So I actually can't remember how much we've covered this story on the show in the last couple of days because it's been bubbling away in the background, but it's just been another example of like diplomatic incompetence. It emerged earlier this week that the South African military was going to be holding military naval exercises with Russia and China right as the G20 summit was happening. In other words, we were going to be holding military exercises with some of the West's biggest geopolitical adversaries right as, you know, all their delegates were supposed to be visiting us here. The US in particular, which is already not in good terms with South Africa, was taking offense to this. But I think also even some of the European countries were a bit shocked by this. Initially, when this news was announced, the Defense Department kind of responded by saying, "Oh well, you know, whatever, we can do what we want. This thing was planned ages ago. It's not a big deal. Get over it. You know, we can exercise with whoever we want. And besides, it's a BRICS exercise, as in part of the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa group." Of course, it is not actually a BRICS exercise. While Russia and China are both members of BRICS, they are not, in fact, this was not, in fact, a military exercise. BRICS doesn't have a military component to it. So that was a bizarre defense. And they kept defending it right up until, obviously, someone in the presidency went, "Oh no, this is actually terrible for our diplomatic maneuvering." And yesterday, the Defense Department announced that it's looking now to postpone the joint naval exercises. They say this is the third iteration of the exercise, which takes place every 2 years between these BRICS partners, continuing to refer to it as a BRICS event for some reason. They say that they are postponing it to, quote, "ensure that the exercises do not impact on the logistical security and other arrangements associated with South Africa's G20 presidency." There's the comment from Darren Oliver, director at African Defense Review, who said, "While I welcome the postponement of this exercise, it's baffling that South Africa's Department of Defense thought the timing was appropriate in the first place. Not only is it a politically inept move given the country's diplomatic maneuvering around the G20 summit, but it introduces significant operational risks to have ships and personnel committed to an exercise rather than security during such a critical and high-profile event. I cannot understand why, even in its statement announcing the intended postponement, the DoD refers to the exercise as a joint BRICS military exercise." Anlu, it seems to me like this actually wasn't an instruction from the top. When you put this together with the fact that the military chief went off to Iran recently, I really get the feeling that the South African military is kind of doing its own thing. It's gone a bit rogue. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I like Gina's comment that the question is, you mean we have functioning ships? Very interesting. But yeah, I agree with Darren that even considering having it at the same time as the G20 is totally inappropriate. I agree with you in that I think there's something to say for the idea that the Department of Defense has gone somewhat rogue. We, on many occasions now, have seen them following their own insights from perhaps their own ideological beliefs and with whoever they want to align. And the fact that they used this instance to make Cyril the scapegoat, I'm never one to shy away from making him the scapegoat, but in many instances he deserves it. But in this one, he ended up in that position. I also like Darren's analysis. You mentioned it now when you read his quote, in that even after they received that little wrist or slap on the wrist for their Iran diplomacy situation, they just can't seem to help themselves from doing these, stepping outside of the lane and following their own foreign policy ideas. Yeah, as I think part of South Africa, and this is what they mentioned in that press release where they mentioned BRICS so many times, is that this is as part of their furtherance of sound multilateral and bilateral relations. And it's for that reason that they partake in these military exercises. And to that, I think Ricardo, who's a colleague of ours, in his Daily Friend piece today.
Recently joined.
Yes, yeah, he'll be joined.
He'll be on the show hopefully soon. I have yet to ask him, but he should be on the show soon.
He'll hear via the show. This broadcasting. I will not give his surname a go. Sorry, Nick, I'll leave that trouble to you. But yeah, so some of the analysis that he did in this piece on the Daily Friend today is that there's a widening gap between what Pretoria wants to achieve and their actual ability to achieve it. And in this example, it's them thinking that they have this, or they want to be seen as a central figure with soft power in these bilateral and multilateral relations. And I agree with Ricardo that I don't think they have the ability to, as he said, use spectacle as a tool. I think they lack it. Do we really need to remind ourselves that when the Eastern Cape flooded, what did they do? Helicopter a week late. We discussed that so many times on the show already. We've had instances earlier this year again where soldiers either they don't have food or they don't get paid. The military is underfunded. We're well aware of that. And every time we see Treasury need a little bit of budget, where do they cut? They look with big smiles at the military. So yeah, I think there's no benefit to South Africa continuing to pretend that we are something that we really are not. And this is also the point that Ricardo was making, which is that South Africa has this legacy of liberation, and we should find those special levers that can help us to get back our credibility by actually showcasing what we have and not pretending to be something with something that we don't have.
Right, you know, our declining economic power, the decay of the military, our decay of our sort of diplomatic service, which, as our colleague Terence Corrigan has often pointed out, is, you know, woefully underskilled. We have all these diplomatic outposts and embassies and stuff all over the world, but often we don't have staff who have, for example, skills in the local languages or any real contacts in the local political establishment. And, you know, the result is we're sort of pretending to be part of this big international movement, BRICS. But BRICS seems far more important to South Africa than it does to any of the other members of BRICS, which I think is very telling. But yeah, so go check out Ricardo's piece on thedailyfriend.co.za discussing this. I think the last thing I want to mention is this does seem to be another indicator of Cyril Ramaphosa just generally not being a strong president. You know, this is pretty much his own party. You know, the ANC firmly controls the defense and foreign policy portfolios in government. They've guarded the powers over those very jealously. And yet the government's different departments seem to be working at odds with each other. They're not cooperating. You know, and I think that's really what we're seeing here. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. And I think they don't even have the excuse of it's a DA minister or a DA department. This is their own department. And the fact that they are willing enough to think that the consequences are worth bearing to make Cyril the scapegoat speaks volumes. I do wonder, though, something that caught my attention is the fact that China is hosting, but it's in South Africa. Is that normal? Is that usually how these things work? Is that, or is it something special? Do we know?
Yeah, that does seem strange. We'd have to check with Ricardo as he is better on defense questions. But yeah, anyway, just bizarre. Okay, let's move on to our next story. This is something that's been getting quite a bit of national attention recently from various figures. I know Helen Zille recently, she did like a guest hosting in August of Power FM, where she raised this issue in conversation with the premier of Limpopo, who's also been raising the issue. It was one of those rare moments in South Africa where we've seen sort of cross-party collaboration between the DA and the ANC. But that is the scourge of teenage pregnancies. The most concerning of these are children between the ages of 10 and 14 who've been getting pregnant and giving birth. Now, some of these cases are children sleeping with other children, and then that, you know, that results in obviously teen pregnancy. But a shocking number of them are statutory rape cases where someone older than the age of consent is sleeping with someone under the age of consent. And that is obviously a huge problem for socially, and also it's a criminal issue. Statistics show that more than 100 children between the ages of 10 and 14 have given birth in the Eastern Cape between April and July of this year. So just in those months, there've been 100 kids who have given birth in the Eastern Cape. Nearly 5,000 teenagers older than that have delivered babies in the same period. The director of the Teddy Bear Clinic has said that this is just something that has been left for far too long. It's a national pandemic, and the president has to address it. We have to declare this is a national pandemic, because the reality is that South Africa has increasing numbers of children giving birth to children. We know that there is learner-on-learner sexual abuse, but there's lots of adults on learner and education on learner, and those are the cases, the statutory rape cases that are not coming to the fore. What we are getting are only the cases that are being reported. And this is obviously a big problem. And I think Zilla made this point when she did that show, is not only, you know, does this cause psychological problems for these girls who are giving birth, you know, way, way too young. Not only is there often, that they're being raped. It's also that when you have a kid at that age, it's very difficult, particularly when you're poor, to get a proper education, to get employment. You're having to look after this kid. It drains your resources, and you're not able to give that child the life that they deserve, or to give yourself the life that you hope to give them. So it's a difficult one to deal with, though, Anlu, because, you know, at the end of the day, obviously police can investigate these cases and they can arrest people guilty of rape, and that would help. But a lot of this is much deeper social rot issues that are going to take a long time to fix. And I think, and tell me if you think I'm right here, this unfortunately has to be something that we can't expect government to really do. This needs to be a social, civil society driven effort to change the way that South Africa deals with these issues. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I was particularly shocked by the numbers. I knew it was an issue in the country, but I must admit, I underestimated the sheer size of the numbers and incidents. And it's bad to have to read that there's a lot of adult on learner and educator on learner situations. And as you mentioned, that there's, it doesn't feed through, the numbers don't correlate with the amount of statutory rape cases actually being reported even. Yeah, it is a very worrying situation. And we obviously know that teenage pregnancies is a very bad situation. It's bad news for a country, especially considering our developmental outlook. Having a baby as a teenager, as you mentioned, means that they'll probably drop out of school, and it starts this entire vicious cycle. But the real problem for me here is, yeah, it is that individual, and it's bad for that obviously teenage girl having and her child and whatever negative consequences comes from that. But if you look at the larger scale, this on national scale, where we have almost, I think, something like 1 out of 7 girls, obviously having teenage pregnancies, then the real problem is that as this next generation of young people enter adulthood, they don't have the adequate education. Their education is affected, their earning potential is affected, and this affects the entire national pool of skills and government dependency. It affects the tax base. It will likely mean longer-term grant dependency. We know we have quite a big child grant system. So it affects government directly at the end of the day as well. And it puts a responsibility to them to also assist in curtailing this. But then to your point of how do we solve this, I agree with you. I don't think, even if government deals with all these statutory rape cases, a large majority of them, at least, it is a social thing. There's certainly an element of where, for example, if we look at where these pregnancies come from, we see that poorer provinces have more pregnancies. We see places like the Western Cape and Gauteng. Those are the only two provinces that has their proportion of teen moms are well above that of the national average. So as these provinces also per capita income in the provinces increase, we see a decrease in these pregnancies. And that puts a responsibility on creating more employment opportunities as well, because if somebody can take care of themselves, it's also, it changes the entire social layout almost. And then something that I picked up here that was particularly worrying to me is the fact that so many of these young teen moms also have HIV, which is a big problem. I think it's close to 1 in 5 women who between those ages gave birth now has HIV, which is a very, very big problem and obviously has its own set of negative consequences. Dealing with it is a very important but very difficult matter.
Yeah, so I think that is the other thing that government can do, of course, is that it can open up. You know, this is exactly yet another reason why economic growth is so important, is that it gives people more resources to deal with these issues, more resources to avoid them. As one of our viewers was commenting now, saying that, you know, there's this thing of sugar daddies. You've got these sort of rich older guys who often sleep around with a lot of these younger girls, and they bribe them essentially with, you know, oh, I'll give you rides in my car, I'll buy food for you and your family, I'll do all these things. And, you know, firstly, that there's been a lot of talk from government about how quite often this is a route of transmission of HIV, and, you know, you see that in some of the numbers. But also then, you know, they settle these girls with kids and then often don't bother to actually support them into old age. So it's you know, if those families had more resources and things, they would have more to resist them. But I think, you know, this is one of those issues that even if we get economic growth, even if we get good policing, it's going to take sort of years of pushing back on this stuff. And I think society is beginning to react to it. You're seeing a lot more discussion about it these days from civil society, from politicians and such. But you know, without those, the improvement of our policing and the improvement of our economy, you know, the progress is going to be limited. So obviously something concerning, but you know, this is once again the cost of our economic policies, is that they do quite directly ruin millions of people's lives.
Yeah. No, definitely. And sorry, just one last point here, something that I picked up and that perhaps speaks to that social element that you're mentioning, is in one of the government's reports on particularly the issue of teenage pregnancies between the period of COVID and 2 years after COVID, 2022. One of the reiterated statements was that it's a lack of family affection. And I wonder if there's something to read into the nature of families in South Africa and the structure of these families. And things like unemployment feed into these family structures that affect how teenagers look at something like teenage pregnancy. I particularly read in this study, it was a survey situation, and one of the young girls said that the fact that there was both her parents weren't working, it was family pressure, and that also affected it. So certainly a social aspect to it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's move on to our next story. You know, this has been this ongoing debate in the country where some of the opposition or former opposition parties, DA, Freedom Front, etc., have been pushing for the devolution of policing powers to provinces. And this has been very aggressively resisted by the ANC, who loves centralization. But interesting thing happened in the Western Cape legislature yesterday when, on a debate on crime in the Western Cape, there have recently been a significant number of shootings. 30 people have been shot dead in the last month in gang-related shootings in the Western Cape. The ANC MPLs, while still saying that the crime was the fault of the DA for not developing communities enough, did sort of accidentally make the case for more devolution of police powers to the provinces by calling on national government to strengthen provincial police intelligence. an ANC-MPL said, it's against the background that we call on the National Commissioner to strengthen provincial police intelligence and urgently appoint a permanent provincial head of police intelligence. Without the police, intelligence policing is blind. And, you know, this is just one example of why, you know, we should have more devolution of powers, which is that, you know, when National drops the ball on policing, as it is in the Western game, as is the rest of the country, the province can't even do anything about it, even if it has the sort of capacity to do so, because government just doesn't allow it. I mean, the fact that crime intelligence has weakened so much and that, you know, there isn't a provincial, permanent provincial head of police intelligence really speaks to how the province, I think, has been failed by national government. What's your take on this?
Yeah, first impressions, not having a permanent commissioner of crime intelligence is a very big problem. We know that the current acting commissioner was the previous directorate for priority crime unit. So he, I can't comment on his abilities, but we know that's the situation. And if we look at the, his predecessor was only appointed in 2022. He was obviously arrested earlier this year, but that's also not a very long time. That's almost just enough time for him to start finding his feet. So the issue that we see pull over through across all government departments is the fact of vacancies. We see that in many departments there are hundreds, if not thousands, of posts left vacant for extended periods of time. And yeah, okay, it seems that it's an obvious problem if you have a vacant post, but let's maybe look at why it is. And one of the reasons is not having a permanent person appointed to a position means that that unit, this very important unit, the crime intelligence one, doesn't have long-term direction. You can't expect of a short-term appointment to be able to find his feet and provide long-term direction for the unit. You have weak oversight.
The problem of vacancies and acting people acting in positions without permanent employment. I mean, the police minister at the moment is an acting police minister.
Yes. Yes. How ironic. No, and I mean, there's just weak oversight. We see the lack of coordination. We see the lack of decisive leadership across all these departments. I mean, and wherever reform is necessary, you can't expect of an acting person to take the responsibility and implement that reform. We're well aware of the cautiousness that acting commissioners or acting posts come with. So yeah, having the position open is a very bad situation in the sense that it's, as long as that position is open, it's open to political interference as well. And for a unit where you rely on intelligence to come to you, to trust you with the intelligence, there needs to be, it, I can see how that leads to hesitancy to actually bring that sensitive information to these units. So a very big issue. I know that SUPS has for a while now been dodging questions about how many vacancies there are, but we know of at least by, I think this was last year this time, around about this time, there was at least 4,500 vacancies. And this is only vacancies being filled by entry-level trainees. And then they've been making use of strategies of re-enlisting or hiring on contract basis former detectives. So we very clearly have a skills mismatch, which is a major issue. Massive, massive crime intelligence problem.
One of our commenters, Gina, points out that while she supports a federal system for our policing, having devolution of police powers to provinces and cities does potentially increase the number of people who could be involved in corruption. You've got these sort of extra structures underneath. And I think there's definitely something to that. You know, this is why I'm always careful to say that devolving police powers to provinces is certainly not a silver bullet. There are no silver bullets in politics. You know, you can imagine a province like Mpumalanga, which we know has big kind of organized crime problems, and its politics is often quite violent and ruthless. You can see the police there being captured by organized criminal forces, and becoming essentially kind of like a almost like a warlord organization in that province, in a way that's worse than it is now. So it's a concern, and I think that's why you need to pair strong national anti-crime anti-corruption police investigative units that sort of make sure the police aren't doing illegal things, that they're following the rules, that they're not taking bribes, et cetera, et cetera. You can still have a unit that specializes in that, that's powerful at the national level, but then allow the provinces to actually make decisions for themselves. The other advantage of this is that people get a better sense of what the province actually does for them, right? When the province is controlling your policing in a real way, it's easier to hold them accountable. You don't have to change the whole national government in order to change the policing policy in your province. So federalism does have some downsides. You could see, oh, well, you know, the Western Cape gets federal powers and it starts reducing crime in the province. And I'm sure it could probably do that. But then you'd see a province in Mpumalanga where things might actually get worse. But that's why you also then need, you know, that's the structures within the police system that are able to make sure the police force is trustworthy and that those kind of figures don't flourish, even in a federal system like that. So something to consider, but it's all part of the reform we need to stop having such a centralized system. It's inefficient. It makes changes and differences in policy very difficult, because the national apparatus is too slow and cumbersome, and it has too much of a one-size-fits-all policy. You know, the Western Cape would be able to invest far more resources into busting gangs in a way that maybe, I don't know, the Eastern Cape doesn't. Something to think about. Okay. Let's go on to our last story very quickly here. And this is one of those stories, I think, that just shows how resilient South Africa is, and how, you know, it's always able to kind of come back from government failure in interesting ways. So in 2020, the post office controlled Postbank was, I think, the main way in the country that people got their social grants. Postbank was set up by the post office and by government as this no fees banking way to be able to distribute SASSA grants to millions of South Africans. But as most government institutions do, it ran into all sorts of problems post-2020, particularly with the massive expansion of the number of grant recipients with the Social Relief of Distress grant that was implemented during COVID. There were security issues, there were cyber attacks, there was banking failures, there was the fact that Postbank was supposed to switch SASSA grant recipients over to a more secure card. They had this gold card that needed to be changed to a black card, which had improved security features to prevent various types of fraud. And despite planning to do this in 2021, Postbank only began implementing the system in 2024 and has kept having to postpone the rollout and the switching over to the new card just because it hasn't been done effectively. There are too many people still on the old system. With all these problems, what we've seen is that ordinary people are making the switch to different institutions. You're also able to get SASSA grants from various banks, African Bank, Capitec, and other institutions are able to pay some of these grants, or at least facilitate the payment of these grants. And we now see that in 2025, Postbank has gone from paying 8.2 million grant recipients down to 2 million. And Capitec has gone from around 1 million up to 4 million, and another biggest distributor of social grants. So, you know, even the much vaunted, the ANC always cheers in Parliament every time the number of people on grants is announced, the State of the Nation speech. But even that achievement of government is now increasingly being done by the private sector in terms of its infrastructure. What's the takeaway from this one, Anlu?
Yeah, I think a wonderful example of how fed up South Africans are with a glitching system. I think there are way too many instances where it was postponed, and ordinary South Africans, people receiving their grants, they just want to get their money and go on with their lives. Government is already, they're clearly struggling to get their money and also struggling to get the money to them. A twofold problem. So yeah, I think it's a wonderful point that you make in that South Africans are incredibly resilient, and we see the private sector just stepping in and providing a platform to facilitate this transaction between government and the public. And it's wonderful to see that we have strong banking institutions that can step up and provide this service, essentially, where government fails to do so. And I think we see similar private sector intervention in many other areas, obviously. We've seen, I think, year-on-year change came out last week for transport. And we've seen since the reform that we have seen, rail passenger numbers have almost doubled, which is incredible. That's already a good example of, once again, private sector just stepping in and saving the day, essentially. So I think a wonderful example of South African resilience and private sector, the reason private sector should be able to operate and should be given more leeway to operate and provide those services for us.
One of the central things that we believe at the Institute of Race Relations is that if you give people the space and the opportunity to do things, they will do a lot of things for themselves, because ultimately people want to be, generally speaking, empowered. They want to be able to be free to make their own choices, and they want to live good lives. And if you give them the space to do that, they will create that. And businesses want to make money. People want to get jobs so that they can, you know, have better lives and improve their lives with their kids. And that's really what so many of our policy solutions are based around, is the idea that you just need to give people and businesses and all these things the space to do that. And time and time again in South Africa, we see that when you open the space for people to do things, they more often than not do them. And I think this is yet another example. And of course, now SASA has actually terminated its master services agreement with Postbank, which is coming to an end at the end of September. So that's another strike against another state-owned enterprise failing to do its job. Anyway,
can I add one quick thing? Just on the point of government not standing in the way of private sector, we've seen, when was it? I think a couple of weeks ago, it's not even the only instance, but a couple of weeks ago where people in the municipality tarred the road, or the road hasn't been serviced, it's dirt road, and the community stepped up and assisted in actually getting it done. And the municipality was so upset with them. So even where private sector is trying to step in when government fails, we see government trying to curtail it. I understand that in some instances, if the municipality doesn't fill the pothole themselves, they have very little control over the quality of refill that the pothole gets. But if the pothole was never filled in the first instance...
Pardon me? I think there's a liability issue where... And this is why municipalities tend to avoid. They say, oh, you know, we'll get sued if you don't do it properly, all that sort of thing. But, yes. You know, is it really better to leave the road dangerous with lots of potholes?
Exactly. If it wasn't filled in the first, from the start, then there's no harm done. It's actually just better for it to be filled. So, yeah, governments should just step aside where they fail anyway.
Indeed. All right. I will not be here next week on Monday and Tuesday, but the show will be hosted by Makona Majo. And we will continue to be talking about the news, talking about the problems in South Africa, and talking about how to fix them going forward. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. And we will be back on Monday on the Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.